I think we show up here with a mission. We have tasks, we have lessons, we have things that we have to do while we're here. And for some of us, that's a very short time. And for some, it's a very long time. And some people will have 30 years experience. And some people will have 1 year experience 30 times. Two different approaches. They endlessly keep repeating the same thing over again, and others are growing. It's not the same for anybody. I just talked to somebody just the other day who's got 29 years working at a plant in Indiana. And his real love, he has an apple orchard. He has 290 trees. He knew so much about apples and about all the different kinds of apples and about all the controversy about pesticides and why they have to be used and which ones are safe and which ones aren't and how much water that you have to give them and why you just let nature do it in a certain way and where you plant them and when you harvest them. And he had this whole thing he had discovered about how to keep apples for 6 months by putting them in your refrigerator and keeping them cool, but you've got to keep moisture in there. He said the moisture goes out, and he was so excited about his apples. And yet he spends 99% of his life he's doing something that he doesn't like doing. I said, your bliss is your apples, isn't it? And your apple orchard. Oh, he said, I love it when I'm out there with that. I just feel like I'm with God at that time. I said, is there any way to make this so you don't have to do this other stuff? So that you don't have to spend your life in this sort of inauthentic way where you're always thinking about how much you dislike what you're doing? Well, I've never thought about really making a living at it and all of that. I said, you know, somebody's got to buy apples, and there's applesauce that's got to be made, and there's apple pies that have got to be made, and it's like if you get your bliss, if you know what it is, then it's just a matter of taking some of the risks that go with it, and why not? Why restrict yourself in any way? What I was suggesting to him was, like, give yourself a chance at that. There's two things I think about what you're doing. You've got to love what you do, and you got to do what you love. Everybody can do this. And I don't really think it matters too much what you're doing. But if you don't like it, you have options. The first option that you have is that you can leave it and take the risk that goes with following your bliss. And I know what your question is already. How do I know what my bliss is? Well, I'll come to that. So what you do know is what it isn't. We always know what it isn't, all right? For sure, that's no problem. But you can leave what you're doing, all right? That's number one. Or you can change around your thoughts, the 99% of who you are, about what it is that you're doing. You have that option. You can decide that if you just are not willing to take the risk or you have to stay with this or whatever, that I can change my thoughts toward it. Take it as creative and do all kinds of things with it and say, all right, I'm only going to do this for 6 hours or 8 hours in a day, and then I'm going to get right out into my apple orchards. And this is sort of what this fellow was doing, was learning how to go into this assembly line job that he had and do it and not have such a negative, terrible attitude about it and have fun with it and make it blissful. All right, so you can change, and there's risks involved with all of that for some people. I think that the risks are much less than most of us realize, that they're not really risks at all after a while. They're just like adventures, and they're excitement, and the people who really love you and support you in your life will support you trying new things, all right? And you begin to find out that you can live with a lot less, and that as long as you have joy inside of you, that telling yourself that you have to have a lot of stuff and a lot of accumulations and a lot of that in order to live happily is really a myth for most of us. But how do you find your bliss then? To come back to that question. The answer to that is you don't. You have to let your bliss find you. And your bliss can't find you. I mean, it sounds strange, but your bliss cannot find you. It's like your purpose. It cannot find you as long as you're filled up or clogged up with something else. Here's a wonderful story. There was an expert on Buddhism and Far Eastern religions. And he was a professor at a university. And he had written 4 or 5 books on the subject. And he was really considered a true expert. But he had always wanted to meet a particular Zen saint who lived in India. And so he traveled there with all of his books and with all of his... And he wanted to meet this particular Zen saint, a guru. And when he got there, he introduced himself, he had made an appointment, and he introduced himself, and the man was had just like a loincloth on, and he was very simple, very peaceful, very old, and the expert began talking to him about all the things that he knew about Zen and Buddhism and so on, and the master stopped him and said, "Would you like a cup of tea?" And he said, "Yes, that would be very nice." And so he took a teacup and put it in a saucer, and the man continued to talk about all of the things that he knew about. And the master picked up the tea, and he began to pour it into the cup. And the man continued talking, and then the cup was full, and the master continued to pour. And the tea poured out of the cup and onto the saucer, and as the man talked, he still kept pouring. And the tea was now going onto the floor and onto the man's pants, and finally he stopped him and he said, "Excuse me, but the cup is full. You're pouring, you know, and it's full." He said, and the master stopped him and said, "You are like the cup." He said, "You are so full of everything that you know that you don't have room to let anything else new in." And so many of us are just like that teacup. We're so full of all of the stuff that we have learned and that we've... there's no more room to let anything else in. It's just all pouring out and just going past us and all outside of us. Now, if you can see that metaphor in yourself, you can begin to see that in the eyes of the beginner, there are millions of options. In the eyes of the expert, there are only one or two. So the suggestion to finding your bliss is to always be a beginner on the path. Never become an expert. If you're going to go out and learn tennis and you've never played it before, and someone hands you a racket and they say, "Now, try a drop shot this way." You are open. You are willing. "I'll do that. Now hit a forehand this way. Now, well, try it this way if you move over here. And now try..." It's like the beginner has 1,000 options available to them and will try everything. But if you talk to an expert about how to hit a backhand, they only know one way. Now, that's true not just in tennis. That's true in your business. That's true in your relationships. That's true in everything in your life. Stay a beginner along the path. You can get clogged up, so clogged up with what you know and with the negativity that goes with that and all the rejection, all the judgment that goes with that, because you have to reject all kinds of other points of view in order to make sure that yours is the only one that ever gets heard or ever gets used, that you don't have any room inside of you for something new and something exciting and something different and expanding yourself and so on. So be wary of experts, especially if you're one yourself. Be wary of yourself becoming one, because then you limit yourself. And by limiting yourself, your bliss, your purpose, which is there, can't find you. It's like an artery that's clogged up with cholesterol. I mean, it just can't flow. Nothing can flow through it because it's too clogged. You've got to unclog yourself. And the way you unclog yourself is by opening yourself up and advancing confidently and doing things that make sense to you, that make you feel good, that are of service to others, that are useful to other people, whatever it is that you're doing. It's like the stuff that you're searching for so desperately, and I see so many people out there that are struggling to achieve, struggling to perform, and struggling. Their whole life becomes this struggle to get. And I think to myself, if you just could only understand that there's much more to this. I was watching a show on TV the other day. It was a group of former prostitutes, and each one of them talked about how they got into this business of being a prostitute. And I think of this because I have 6 daughters, and I think that the thought of one of my daughters having to someday go out and, or not even having to, but choosing to go out and sell her body in order to make money. And many of these women came from very fine backgrounds. Every one of them talked about this addiction to money. I was sitting watching with tears coming down my eyes, thinking to myself about the addiction to money. And every one of them said that the thing that they had to get over before they could get out of prostitution was their addiction to money. That they knew about all the dangers of disease and the physical dangers to them and the rottenness of the profession that they found themselves in and how corrupt it was. They knew all of that. And this addiction to money seemed to be so profound, so important to them that one woman had spent 7 years trying to get out of doing this kind of thing because she was making $5,000 or $6,000 a week. for which she didn't pay any taxes on, and which was just like, and she found herself just spending all the time on drugs and on clothes and on jewelry and whatever it was. It was like this addiction that she kept convincing herself that she had to have this stuff. And meantime, the work of art that I'm talking about in this program, that you want your life to become, to unfold this masterpiece, is like the daily activity of your life. And what the daily activity of her life was this revulsion, this loathsomeness that she felt for what she was doing, and her dislike and her hatred, and her life became that. And that's what kept expanding for her, because what you think about is what expands. The more that she would think about how much she hated it, the more hatefulness would become a part of her life. And yet the only reason that she was doing this, according to her, was her addiction to money. And she said, I had to go on a detoxification program. I had to detox myself, not from drugs, not from alcohol, not from anything like that, but from money, from the belief that I couldn't live the kind of life I wanted if I didn't have these large amounts of tax-free money that was coming into my life. Now, in some ways, if you're doing the kinds of things that you don't like, and you're living the kind of life that you find loathsome, and you're constantly in pursuit of just getting more, and getting some kind of an award, or getting a lot of money in your hand, you too are a form of a prostitute. That's a prostitution of your basic divine self, of who you really are. And until you come to that awareness, until you understand within you that this money thing that you've convinced yourself you have to have in order to have success or happiness or joy or harmony in your life, you're never going to get on the path that I'm talking about. You're going to convince yourself that I am only doing what I'm doing because it's going to ultimately get me all of this stuff. I'm going to have all of these things. Meantime, your inner self, the person, the observer that is with you at all times, that voice, that conscience, that inner thought that is basically your humanity. That's what makes us human. That invisible mind that we are always with and always a part of is always in disharmony and disarray. And you don't have to go to the extreme of being a streetwalker or being a pimp or some of the extreme kinds of things that we think of when we think about prostitution and prostituting ourselves in some way or another or being criminals. But in a sense, the same principle is working in you. And if you can get rid of your addiction to the belief that you can't be happy, or that you're doing what you're doing because it's going to give you happiness through your accumulation of this money, I just want to tell you what every single one of those women said, that what you are buying with that money simply isn't worth it. And the cost to your own self, to your own harmony, to your own sense of who you are as a human being, is 10 times greater than what you're getting as a reward.
I had a client. His name was Lou Mastriani. He was a client of mine up in New York. And he came to me for 6-7 weeks of therapy. And we worked together. And after that, I just figured it was over. I was what I call a do-do therapist. You know, you got to go out there and do it now. You're going to just sit here and talk about your mother. I'm just not interested. It's just boring. You know, I got enough of that. I got enough problems with my own mother. I don't want to hear about yours, you know. But if you want to change, then here's what we do. And Lou wanted to sort of talk, and then we got to a point where he knew that it was time to go. These are the things that you've come for, and now you can change and work on them. And he was one of these people who was never happy. He didn't understand the great messages, the great understanding that happiness itself is the way to live life. It isn't something that you're going to ever get. It's something that you bring to life, that success is an inner process. It's something you bring to life. It's not something you get from life. And so in the last day, I told them, I said, Lou, I said, you've always talked to me about how great it was when you were a little boy living out in Sag Harbor and how much you loved to go out to the beach and you'd spend your days at the beach and those were the greatest things. I said, I'm going to give you 4 prescriptions. And these 4 prescriptions I give you, you have to follow them to the T. He said, all right, Wayne, I'll do whatever you want. He always knew I was a little on the loony side. And Lou was sort of, we became buddies. And so I said, you're going to go out to the, I'm going to send you out next Wednesday instead of coming here. You're going to take the day off. He had a furniture business. I said, you're going to close up your business for the day, and you're going out to the beach, and I'm going to give you four prescriptions. And the first prescription, you're going to open at 9 o'clock in the morning when you get there. The second one, you open at noon. The third one at 3, and the last one at 6 o'clock. Will you do it? He said, yeah. I got this from Norman Vincent Peale, who had told me this was a great technique for people who are sort of into that type A, they're always wanting to talk about it. So I gave Lou these four envelopes, and I sealed them, and I wrote this in. And he went out to, he was ready for his day at the beach. He hadn't done it since he was 9 years old. And he opened up the first envelope at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I had written in the envelope inside, I had written the word, listen. That's all. And for 3 hours, he had to walk up and down the beach and just listen. Just listen to the birds, to the ocean, to the wind, to all the beautiful things that the beach has to offer. Just be there in the moment. And he did that for 3 hours. And then at noon, he got to the second envelope and I had written in there, reach back. And then there was a poem that I had put on there by James Cavanaugh, which I have in my parenting book on raising kids. It's called Little Boy, I Miss You. God, you guys could listen to this. James Cavanaugh wrote it on his 45th birthday, the day his brother died, who was only a year older than him. Some kind of nervous, crazy disorder. Goes like this. Little boy, I miss you. With your sudden smile and your ignorance of pain, you walk through life and devoured it with nothing but misty goals to keep you company. You wandered through quiet woods with friends and you were startled by a shuffling porcupine. Your heart beat mightily when you chased frogs and caught one too big for a single hand. There was no time for meaning. A marshmallow gave it on a sharpened stick. A jackknife in your pocket gave you comfort when your friends were gone. A flower hidden in the woods behind an aging, shriveled log. A dog who licked at your fingers and chewed at your jeans. A game of football that you didn't expect. A glass of cider. A cricket's cry. When did you lose your eyes and ears? When did taste buds cease to tremble? When's this sullenness, this mounting fear, this quarrel with life demanding meaning? That mounting fear is leisure's bonus, and it's the pain that forbids you to be a boy, be a girl. I had Lou think about that for 3 hours. Reach back, and don't let an old person move in. Don't let a tired person move in. Don't let a sick person move in. Not into this beautiful form that you inherited. And at 3 o'clock, I had written on there, as he opened the envelope, re-examine your priorities, which I'd encourage all of you to do. Who are the most important people in your life? Who are they? What would you do if you had 6 months to live and you knew it? How would you spend that time? Who would you be with? You got kids and you don't have time for them because you're too busy? Be with those kids. Teach them how to play ball. You're not raising grass, you're raising kids. Be there for your wife. Tell her how much you love her. Send love out wherever you can, and you'll see the success that you're chasing so desperately come jumping into your life. Re-examine your priorities. Walk as you talk. Be there for the people you love, and you'll see your business and everything else growing. And at 6 o'clock, I had Lou write the final envelope, and I'd encourage all of you to do it. I said, Lou, now write your worries in the sand and see how long they stay there.
I tell people, supposing you went to sleep and you had a dream, and in your dream you had all these different characters, and you had all of this money, and you had everything that you wanted in your dream. And then you woke up, and then you look back at your dream, and you became attached to the stuff that you had in your dream. And you said, wait a minute, I want that. There was gold in there. There was silver. There was all of these friends. I had a Ferrari there. I mean, all of this. I got to have this. Somebody would come away and cart you off and put you in a rubber room and say, that was a dream. You can't be attached to that. That's just a thought that you have. That's the way you got to view life. Instead of it being an 8-hour dream, it's an 80-year dream or a 90-year dream. And at the end of the dream, you don't want to be looking back at all of the stuff that you wish you could still have because you can't have it. You don't get any of that. So you try to detach yourself now while you're here, while you're alive, from the need to have that stuff. Instead, you just let it sort of all flow. As absurd as it would be for you to be attached to the stuff that you had in your dream, it's that absurd for you to be attached to the stuff that you're having in this dream. You have to die while you're alive. Now, that's a very hard concept for people to get. But you have to experience your own death while you're alive. Let me tell you a story. It's a wonderful story. It's an old, ancient story. I'll paraphrase it. There was a hunter who lived in India. And he would go to Africa every 2 years. And he would bring back animals and prizes and things like that. Well, 1 year he took off and he went to the jungle. And he discovered this large enclave inside the jungle. And it was filled with beautiful parrots, beautiful birds, multicolored, and they all talked. And he couldn't get over it. And he put a net out over one of the trees, and he captured one of the parrots. And he put the parrot in a cage. And he brought the parrot back to be with him in India as his pet. And he fed the parrot sunflower seeds, and he fed him rice, and he took wonderful care of him. He was very good. Kept him in the cage. 2 years went by, and he talked to the parrot every day. And he said to the parrot, I'm now going back to Africa. Is there anything you would like me to say to your friends back there in the jungle when I'm back there? The parrot said, yes. Tell them that I'm very happy in my cage. Tell them that I'm joyful and that I love being in my cage here with you. Just tell them that. The hunter went back to Africa. He went back to the place in the jungle where he had been 2 years before. And he told the story. He said, your friend that I took back has a message for you. And the message is that he is happy in his cage, that he is joyful with me, and that he has no regrets. At the instant of hearing that, a bird on one of the branches keeled over and dropped dead. Dropped dead. Stiff. The hunter assumed that he was just filled with sorrow at hearing of what had happened to his friend. So he went back to India, and he told his parrot what had happened. He said, I went back and I did just as you said. And I told them all out there, and at the moment that I told it, apparently one of the parrots was so upset that he'd missed you so much that he just dropped dead. And at the instant that that happened, the parrot in the cage keeled over dead. His legs went straight up in the air, and he went stiff. The hunter was beside himself. He couldn't figure out how could this happen. And he took the dead parrot out of the cage, opened it up, and threw it out on the woodpile. The instant that the parrot landed on the woodpile, he flew up to the branch. And the hunter said, you tricked me. What is this? I thought you were dead. And the parrot said, my friend was sending me a message. He told me, by his actions, that in order for you to escape from your cage, you must die while you're alive. Okay, now that's an old story. That's an ancient story that's been told over the years. What does it mean? I mean, don't you see that this is a cage? That the whole planet is a cage? If you can just stand back far enough and see that we're still restricted by the limitations placed on us as human beings. we're stuck here, or maybe in our homes, or in wherever we are, we're all in cages. And even though we have more room to manipulate, we may even have a whole planet, we're still sort of in cages. Now, how do you escape from the cage that you're in? You have to die while you're alive. You have to literally experience your own death. All of us have to. All of us are going to die. So why not experience it in advance and see yourself out of your body, gone, but able to look back at what's going on now, just like the dream, where you have the dream and you have everything you want, but you're able to look back at it. As you do that, you begin to see the folly, the absurdity of hanging on to anything, of being attached to anything, of needing anything, of telling yourself that I can't be happy if, from the perspective of having died, but being able to look back on it, just like the dream. As soon as you can do that, as soon as you can experience yourself formless, dimensionless, form and all of the attendant things that you hang on to become irrelevant. They're not necessary any longer. You have a whole new way of living, a new way of being. Let's make it real clear that when I say we have to die while we're alive, that this is not a physical act. You certainly don't have to die and experience your own death. What you have to do is you have to do that in your mind. You have to really see yourself. And that's, by the way, when they train people in meditation and in becoming high spiritual masters and so on, they literally expect them to experience their own death, to know what it's like, to feel it inside. For me, how I apply it in my life is that I keep reminding myself that an 8-hour dream and an 80-year dream are basically the same if there's no such thing as time. And I keep reminding myself that being attached to anything in the sense of needing it and having to have it and identifying and defining myself by the acquisition or the getting someplace by those kinds of acts is absurd from the perspective of my no longer being here in form. I'm like Carl Jung when they said, do you believe in life after death? Or do you believe there's a God? He had studied it all of his life. He said, no. He said, I don't believe it. I know it. He said, I absolutely know it, that you cannot kill thought. You cannot kill spirit. You cannot kill the higher consciousness. That's part of the eternity, just like the universe is eternal. So too are you. So when you know that and live that, then it becomes less and less scary, the idea of your form dying. So I try to look at everything that I'm doing from the perspective of being able to look back at it from the point of not being here any longer, from the point of being dead, or from the point of when I'm looking back at what was in my dream. While you're in the dream, everything that you're doing is very real, very exciting, very exquisite. It's not like you're going through it and saying, oh, this doesn't count. I got my fingers crossed. There's no countsies on this. That isn't the way it is. You're experiencing. But when you awaken, you don't look back on it and say, oh, I want all of that stuff back. I have to have that. If I didn't get this and if I only would have done it this way. You don't do any of that. You just move on. You just move on to the next level. And that's pretty much what I'm talking about here. You now have a new perspective. And the perspective is of not needing anything in a very short time. In a very short time for all of us. I mean, it's just a speck away in an eternity. It's just a speck away. We won't need any of this stuff. Try to detach yourself from it now so that you can flow, so that you can be part of that perfection instead of always worrying, always angry, always hurting, always suffering, all of that suffering. See, all suffering gets played out in form. There's no suffering in thought. There's no suffering there. And that was the thing that my sister-in-law, Marilyn, said, that there was no suffering. There was her body going through all this pain, all this suffering and everything, and she wasn't suffering at all. Who she was wasn't suffering. There doesn't have to be suffering if you can really live there. You don't have to have a terrible accident or come close to death or anything like that to do this. You can really get that new perspective of looking back on all of this that you're doing now from the perspective of no longer having to have anything or own anything. That your humanity, your divineness, isn't in things and acquisitions. It's in how you think.